Imagine the feeling of being attacked, ripped away from your two young children, and taken against your will. You're tied up, forced into a vehicle, and driven to an unknown location. The panic, the fear, the overwhelming sense of helplessness as you realize you have no way to call for help. In those terrifying moments, all you can think about is the desperate need for a lifeline, a way to reach out to someone, anyone. Imagine then that you manage to grab a cell phone, and further still, that you manage to call 911. What a relief, you think, as you tell the operator your name and what happened. You're saved. Or are you? I'm Laura. I'm here with my best friend, Marina, and this is Grimm.
No, I don't either.
And I know what happens, but that's why I don't like it.
I only want to be ripped away from my children if it's between 4 and 7 p.m. on a weekday.
I was actually thinking that because just before recording this, we were working on putting the kids to bed. So I was thinking, you are imagining that. Okay. So first of all, sorry for my voice again, still, always, for the next however many years, I'm going to be sick from daycare. The good news is I feel great. I just sound not great. So I'm sorry. It's just my radio voice.
Smelly cat, smelly cat.
Anyway, okay, so what's going to be really fun is Patreon shoutouts because my higher register doesn't work.
Okay.
So you may have to fill me
I'll
in
here.
I'll
go high for you.
Yeah, I'll go low. Okay, perfect. So we do have a lot of Patreon shoutouts, and I just want to say thank you so much in advance, and then we'll say thank you each time. But there's so many, and you guys are so awesome.
Whoop, whoop.
All right. Yeah, I can't do that. Whoop, whoop.
You want to harmonize?
Whoop, whoop. Whoop. Okay, that was funny. All right, first up we have Patty S.
Patty S, woo-woo. Woo-woo.
Okay.
we love you. Don't do it. Don't do it.
Okay, sorry. I'm sorry, Patty. You're awesome. Bella C.
Bella Woo, C, Bella. We love you.
Ooh, there it is. Woo. Jules.
Jules, Woo, we Jules. Love you. Thank we you love so Jules. Much, Jules.
Aaron M.
Aaron M. Woo, Aaron. Thank you so much. We love you.
Robin L.
Robin Woo, L. Robin, we love you. We love thank you. You so much.
Neve.
Neve, we love you. We thank love you, Neve.
Jen J.
Jen J. Woo, we Jen. Love you, Jen.
We love you. Woo-hoo. I tried. Addie P.
Addie Woo, P, we Addie, love you. We thank love you so thank much.
Thank you, Addie. Alex M.
Alex M, thank you so Alex, much. We love
Woo,
you.
We love Woo-hoo. You, Alex. Johnny M.
Johnny M.
Woo, Johnny.
Woo, we love you.
We love you. And Allie H.
Allie H, we love you. Woo-hoo.
We love you.
You guys are awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. We love you. Did you get that? We love you.
We love you.
Okay.
Did we mention?
We love you.
We love you.
We harmonized that too. All right. So for this case, I scoured the interwebs and I did a lot of checking and cross-checking, including reading through as many court documents as I could find.
Okay.
I came to two conclusions. One, I read a lot about the case, so I have some thoughts there. And two, that I could not, in fact, be a lawyer because I was reading the, I don't even know what to call it, the appeal documents.
The appellate briefs?
Yes, question mark.
Okay.
It was like the decision from the Supreme Court on the appeal. Spoiler alert.
So it's the appellate decision.
Okay. So I was reading that. Don't know how many pages. Sorry. Didn't. I know.
I'm disappointed.
And I was reading through and I was like, yeah. Yep. I got it. Okay. I get the point. And I was thinking to myself, like, I don't think you can do that as a lawyer. I think you actually need to read everything and read all the details. That's what it's about.
You do. And if you don't, you could be like the people that quote a decision for like, they just pull like a random quote from the beginning. And I'm like, if you kept reading, it actually is distinctly against you.
Mm-hmm. I did read for that exact reason. I did indeed read the whole thing.
Okay.
So don't come for me. I did.
Okay.
But I just continue to respect. I know you're not doing this work anymore, but yes, specifically.
Thank
you.
You
do read.
I do still have to read things.
Lots of things.
I do still read in my job. So.
I do too. Oh my gosh. Okay. All right. You ready?
Ready.
Get into it. Okay. Denise Amber Goff was born in Englewood, Florida on August 6th, 1986 to parents Rick and Sue Goff. The Goff family wasn't new to Englewood. Rick's great-great-great-grandfather was the very first to settle there in 1876. Rick grew his own roots working as a detective for the Charlotte County Sheriff's Office, which is where Englewood is. Denise was quiet and smart. In her senior year, when she was 17, she was taking classes at nearby Manatee Community College, no relation to the sea animal. In one of her math classes, she met 19-year-old Nathan Lee. According to Nate, she was the bookworm and math ace, and he hung with the cool kids and the ball players. Interestingly, she was the one who asked him out.
Hmm.
On their first Valentine's Day, 3 weeks after their first date, Nathan bought her a $40, which, by the way, that's a lot, I think. 3 weeks after your dating in high school-ish, yeah, or early college. I don't know.
Well, what was it?
I'm sorry, I interrupted myself. A heart-shaped ring, which she kept wearing ever since.
Oh. So,
no, not diamond or anything, but...
Because if you were going to say $40 chocolates, I would have been like, God damn, those are expensive chocolates. A ring? I don't know, but yeah, 3 weeks.
I hate it when my own thought gets interrupted by my own thought.
You're so intrusive.
Denise went on to graduate magna cum laude from Lemon Bay High School in 2004. The two got married soon after, and by the time Denise was 21, they had two young children, Noah, who was two, and Adam, who was six months old. Six is a hard one for me tonight. Nate had finished college and began work. Denise had dropped out of school to take care of the children full time. And Nate actually worked three jobs to support the family.
Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm. They moved into a rented house in Northport, Florida, next door to Englewood. Northport is known for its beautiful surroundings, including expansive parks, wildlife preserves, and waterways. The city is also home to numerous shopping and dining options, as well as a variety of recreational activities such as golfing and hiking and boating. It has a population of 70,000 residents and has seen significant development. The city is a popular destination for both tourists and retirees, thanks to the warm climate, low cost of living, and laid-back atmosphere. In addition to its natural attractions, Northport is also home to cultural and entertainment venues. The city hosts various events and festivals throughout the year, celebrating its diverse community and vibrant arts scene, including the Northport Performing Arts Center and the Northport Symphony. In fact, Nate played trumpet in the nearby Venice Symphony. So this is a desirable place for them. It's a really great, quiet, and developing city.
This is California, right?
Florida. Close.
Oh.
It's warm.
Venice and Inglewood, aren't those both in California too?
I think Venice definitely. Well, Venice Beach, but I don't know about probably Inglewood. I don't know. We repeat towns all over the place. So
okay. All right. But Florida.
Yes, Florida. Still warm, just okay. East Coast.
Yes.
Now, Nate and Denise moved into a new construction home at 7912 Latour Avenue in a developing subdivision. The house had three beds and two baths, which was great for their family. And since the neighborhood was only partially finished, it was very quiet.
Mm.
And this is grim. Mm-hmm. So that's where the happiness ends. On Thursday, January 17th, 2008, Nate had gone to his job as a meter reader. Denise was home with the kids. They were on the back porch where she was cutting Noah's hair. Denise last spoke to Nate on the phone at 11:21 a.m. just to say hi, like they did most today's. They talked about the weather, airing out the house. Denise said she had already opened up the windows. Wrapping up for the day, Nate called again at 3 o'clock, but Denise didn't answer. Very strange. He called 8 more times in the 25-minute drive home, becoming increasingly worried, which is definitely something I would do. Because I would call once, somebody wouldn't answer, and I'd be like, oh, that's concerning. I'd be like, 2 minutes later, let me just call again.
Yeah.
And it would get worse and worse until I was in a complete panic by the time I got home.
Yep.
I think that was probably the case for him, and it didn't get better. He arrived home just before 3:30 and immediately noticed that the windows were closed, conflicting with what Denise had told him earlier. More disturbing, there was no sign of Denise, and the two kids were together in one of their cribs, crying with no one else home.
No.
The air hadn't been turned back on, and it's hard to imagine in early spring here in the Northeast, but it was hot in the house. Interestingly, the windows had been closed but not latched. Denise's phone and keys were on a chair. Panicked now, Nate called 911. After he talked to the police, he called his father-in-law, Rick. Again, remember, he was a detective in the neighboring Charlotte County. Rick told Nate that he had also been trying to get a hold of Denise that day to invite everyone over for dinner, but hadn't heard from her. Concerned for his daughter's well-being, Rick helped ensure that the search happened quickly. Soon, officers were walking the banks of nearby ponds and riding through the woods on ATVs. A bloodhound searched around the home, and a helicopter flew overhead. They also began talking to neighbors. One neighbor, Jennifer Eckert, told... Oh, interesting. I put... There's... I wrote 5 EM. I'm pretty sure I meant them. I was like, is that a code for something?
Eastern Mountain.
Yeah. Jennifer Eckert told them she had seen a car, a dark green sedan, maybe 10 years old, arrive at Denise's house at 2 PM. The car, which had been earlier driving slowly up and down the street, had been sitting in the Lee's driveway for 15 minutes. Jennifer went back inside, and when she came back out 10 minutes later, it was gone. That car belonged to a man named Michael King. Michael was born on May 4th, 1971. He had been a plumber, but at the time was unemployed. He had apparently just stopped showing up to work 3 months earlier and was fired for also lying to his boss, who called him a habitual liar. His home, which was also in Northport on the other side of town, was going to be foreclosed on. Michael had previously been married, but divorced very much not amicably in 2002. He had a low IQ, 76, and family members say it's due to a sledding incident when he was 6. His brother said he suffered from headaches and a buzzing noise in his head.
Oh, boy.
And that he would occasionally become violent.
That frontal lobe, man.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. Yep. This is confirmed by a neighbor who said Michael had thrown battery acid on her pool cage and slashed her car tires. Another neighbor said he'd stalked her daughter from the bus stop.
Not important. What's a pool cage?
In Florida, it's those...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, wait.
We're still in Florida.
Yes. No, I understand. Okay. I was picturing like a pool pump like covered in a...
Okay.
Like in a little prison cell, but that's not at all what it is.
Nope. Nope.
Okay.
Nope. Anyway, continuing. We live in the Northeast. Yes.
I know what a pool cage is now, though. Thank you.
Just 2 hours before Denise went missing, Michael was at a local gun range. He had also been to visit a bankruptcy lawyer. He had no criminal history, but a disturbing past nonetheless. The owner of a beauty salon at which Michael was a regular said he was generally quiet, but one time he brought in a girl who he said was 15. Why he would even admit that, I don't know. And they started kissing. Also very strange. This is a salon.
Okay.
Ew. This is a Wendy's, ma'am. and Michael told the salon owner that they met online. Another worker reported that Michael had exposed himself to a woman while he was working, but this too was not reported to the police. So he's got some trouble.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some issues there.
Yeah. Who knows what made him choose the Lee household? Had he seen Denise around town? Was it random? Did he think the house was empty and plan to ransack it? All we know is that on that fateful afternoon, Michael attacked Denise, thankfully not doing anything to the boys. He managed to get control of her and tie her up, dragging her out to his car. It is so unlikely and so unfortunate that he did so when Jennifer, the neighbor, went inside and didn't witness it. Yep. Once he got Denise in the car, he drove her around before finally bringing her to his house, where he brought her to what he called his rape room. Ugh. After he was done, he brought her to his cousin's house, Harold Muxlow. Sorry, that's a really hard name. Harold. Muxlow. Okay. Where he borrowed a shovel, gas can, and flashlight.
Oh, no.
While he was in his cousin's house, Denise managed to use his phone to call 911. The call came in at 6:14 p.m. She gave the operator information that she had been abducted, under what circumstances that she had been abducted, begging the operator to save her life, saying please 17 times. But what's crazy is that Michael was back in the car when she was doing this. So she got the phone and he didn't realize it, but then he got back in the car. She stayed on the phone with the operator, but pretended like she was talking to Michael. Mm-hmm. She was able to give answers to the operator's questions, although she wasn't sure of her exact location. The call ended after 7 minutes when he asks, "Where's the phone?" And she says she doesn't know. Police were unable to trace the call because it was a prepaid cell phone. They could get pings from the cell towers, but it was a general area and not very helpful. But tracing the phone did give them Michael King's name.
Okay.
Shortly after this call ended, another call came in at 6:23 p.m. This was from Sabrina Muxlow, Michael's cousin's 17-year-old daughter. She said that Michael had arrived at their house and come in, and then a girl who was tied up had gotten out of the car. Michael saw her and put her back in the car.
Oh, my gosh.
Another frantic call came in just a few minutes later. Jane Kowalski said she was watching a crime happening right next to her while she was driving. She told the operator that she heard screaming from the car next to her at a stoplight. She actually thought it was a child abduction. She reported that it was a Camaro, either black or blue. And when they'd pulled up to the light, she heard awful screaming and looked at the driver like, what the fuck? And then a hand came up and started banging on the passenger window. Jane reported her exact location, even thinking to name cross streets, and then continued to track the Camaro, but it was actually behind her. And then it turned off onto a side street. This call, which was more than 9 minutes, was routed to Charlotte County operators since she had crossed the county line. One other witness called 911. This one was from a payphone. The caller said that they had seen a 95 green Camaro and that there was, quote, somebody that's been taken without their, they don't want to be where they need to be.
Okay. That's one way to put it.
Yep. The caller wanted to be anonymous and wouldn't give a lot of details and was like clearly uncomfortable with the call. But ultimately, the police figured out that it was actually Harold Muxlow, Michael's cousin.
Oh.
He said that Michael had come by for the gas can, shovel, and flashlight, saying, my lawnmower broke down and got stuck in a ditch. Okay. Then recounted the same thing his daughter had said, that Denise got out of the car, struggled with Michael, yelling, call the cops, before Michael could shove her back in the car.
I really hope she survives because so many people, oh, you're making a face that leads me to believe she doesn't, but
I was like, you can hope.
So many people called to like triangulate her location.
So many. Police actually were just behind Michael. They got to his house at 6:42 p.m., but he had already left. Based on the 911 calls from the witnesses and the building evidence, a bolo was put out. At 9 p.m., deputies, I wrote 9 p.m. that evening. That's why I stumbled in. I don't like having it repeat itself.
Okay.
So when people say like 9 a.m. in the morning, like, yes, that's when it is. At 9 p.m. in the evening, Deputy Christian Weimer and State Trooper Edward Pope were posted at Toledo Blade Boulevard near I-75 watching for a green Camaro. The officers had a description of the car, a license plate number, and driver's license photos of Denise and Michael. At approximately 9:10 p.m. in the evening, they saw a green Camaro matching the description given in the bolo. Trooper Pope, and just an asterisk, I am guarantee you I'm going to say Trooper Poop, without a doubt. Trooper Pope followed the Camaro and eventually got it to stop. Based on the information he had at the time, Trooper Pope conducted a felony stop, placing his vehicle in a tactical position and drawing his weapon. He ordered Michael to exit the vehicle multiple times, but Michael did not comply. Only after a fifth command, during which Trooper Pope advised that if the driver did not comply, he would fire into the vehicle, the door opened, and Michael exited from the front door backwards. Trooper Pope identified the driver as a perfect match to the person on Michael King's driver's license. During the stop, Trooper Pope observed that Michael was wet from the waist down and had mud on the bottom of his shoes.
No.
Michael was wearing jeans and a shirt with a camouflage pattern. Trooper Pope recovered a cell phone from which the battery and SIM card had been removed. On the front of the Camaro, Trooper Pope observed hair strands, and he also observed hair strands on the spoiler with what appeared to be blood pellets. Inside the vehicle, Trooper Pope observed a gas can on the passenger seat and a cell phone battery on the passenger side floorboard. Finally, Trooper Pope observed a blanket and a ring in the back seat. Michael was subsequently arrested.
Oh, is it the $40 ring?
Yes, aww. It is. Upon interrogation, Michael said he and Denise had both been victims of kidnapping. Mm. He said they'd been blindfolded, so he didn't know what the kidnapper did to Denise. They had him take them to an area near his house where the kidnapper might have taken them, but nothing turned up, of course.
Like
not.
18 people witnessed this guy take her, and he's like, no, but I was taken too.
Exactly.
No, you were not,
he probably
sir.
Sounded exactly like that, actually. In reality, of course, Michael had shot Denise, killing her, and then leaving her in a shallow grave. In fact, he had been returning from burying her when he was picked up by police. Denise's body was finally found on January 19th, 2 days later. They were looking in a marshy field when one of the searchers noticed an area where the dirt had been disturbed. Looking more closely, they found that there were two piles of sand with what appeared to be blood in them, as if someone had put the sand on the blood to absorb it. Mm. They began excavating the area and noticed shovel marks. Once they got 3 feet down, they found Denise's nude body. She was lying on her side in the fetal position. A gunshot wound was visible. She had been shot in the head just to the right of her right eyebrow. A couple of hundred yards away, they found a pair of boxers and a shirt that Denise often wore, like her husband's stuff. I don't know why that made me extra sad, because that's just like a comfort. You know, she was just at home cutting her kid's hair one minute, and it just makes me sad. Michael was convicted of kidnapping, sexual battery, and first-degree murder. He pleaded not guilty. Michael's trial started on August 24th, 2009. The lead prosecutor was attorney Lon Arend. The lead defense attorney was Carolyn Schlemmer. She was a public defender assigned to Michael as he couldn't afford to hire his own lawyer. Mm-hmm. The state used DNA and other forensic evidence to build their case, and boy, did they have plenty to choose from. On those boxers, they found sperm that matched to Michael's DNA profile to the exclusion of 3.5 trillion other individuals.
So it was his sperm?
Questionably. A reasonable person might think so.
Scientists will not say that that is conclusively his DNA. Isn't that crazy? Yeah.
Isn't that crazy? In Michael's house, they found a yellow blanket covering the window in the primary bedroom, what we can assume is his rape room. A Winnie the Pooh blanket, pillows, and a wad of duct tape with hair were attached were on the floor. Swabs taken from the end of the wadded duct tape matched Michael's known DNA profile to the exclusion of 1 quadrillion other individuals.
Why is it a Winnie the Pooh blanket?
I don't know.
That's very like Casey Anthony of him.
It's very strange because it's, I don't know, I don't. Because he doesn't have kids. Oh, wait. Does he? I think he does have a daughter. But so maybe she had been there. Yeah.
Okay.
Unrelated to what happened in this event.
Yeah. And I feel like you would have told me if you knew. But is he calling it his rape room just because he raped her in that room? Or did he do this to other people?
It's a good question. And I don't know. I didn't see anything that indicated. Because
I know he didn't have a criminal history. You right. said that.
And there was nothing to my knowledge in what I read or anything that I found that mentioned any other crimes like this. So I don't know that if he created it for this. And that's what I mean. Like, I don't know why he targeted Denise. Like, he hasn't admitted to any of this. So we have a lot of unanswered questions, unfortunately. Yeah. The Winnie the Pooh blanket tested positive for blood and semen. The semen on the blanket matched Michael's known DNA profile to the exclusion of 1.1 quadrillion other individuals. In the kitchen, they found an intact roll of duct tape on the bar. A garbage bag in the pantry contained more duct tape with hair attached. Mm. The hairs that were attached to the duct tape in the garbage bag matched Denise's DNA profile to the exclusion of 110 trillion other individuals.
So this is pretty solid evidence.
Like I said, they have some.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is pretty solid.
Let's keep adding to it.
Okay.
In Michael's car, they found chunks of Denise's hair pulled out by the root and stuck under the seat.
Oh, God, was she doing that?
Nate theorized exactly that she did it herself to help them with the evidence. Because she watched a lot of crime shows. I don't think she listened to Grimm. But knew you needed the root of the hair to make the positive DNA match.
Oh my God, what a badass bitch. She's just like ripping out chunks literally. Of her hair.
Yep.
Oh my gosh.
And Nate also felt that she planted the ring. So you're right. It was the ring that he gave her for their first Valentine's Day. He said the ring didn't come off very easily. So it's not like it just fell off. I know she placed it there and it's the only ring I know she would have been 100% sure I would have been able to identify, which just gave me chills again. Heartbreaking. Oh,
that's so sad.
This is one of those cases that I can't actually put myself, like I try to put myself in, it sounds bad, but put myself in the victim's minds everywhere just to imagine. And I almost can't do it in this one because it's so upsetting to me to think about you're just living your life with your two beautiful young children and then you're taken away and you're thinking you have hope. You think you might be able to survive it.
Right.
And you aren't. It's just, it.
And it's the random, the yes. randomness of it too.
Yes. She didn't, like Nate said, he had absolutely no idea who Michael was. No reason. There's nothing to indicate they would have known each other. And it's not clear why Michael chose their house. Again, it was a partially developed subdivision. So it's a little quieter, not as much traffic. But man, this is one of those cases that just makes my stomach turn.
And the majority of crime is committed by people that you know.
That's true.
But it is just these one-off random cases that you hear about, like the Cheshire home invasion where they were just picked randomly in the Stop and Shop parking lot. Like cases like that makes me paranoid about everyday life.
Yeah, to the point where you can't think about it.
Right.
At all. Ugh. Yeah. They also used the clothes Michael changed out of, duct tape, and a shell casing, the shovel, and his cell phone for evidence. So, like I said, they've got plenty. Mm-hmm. They called the eyewitnesses that we talked about, including his cousin. And Michael's semen and Denise's blood were on the duct tape on her wrists as well as her shorts found near the body. So just piling up.
I can't wait to hear about this appeal.
there's not, you're going to be disappointed. Okay. Well, maybe not disappointed because Michael deserves to be in jail. I always find a way to hit the microphone.
You do. And again. To
hit the microphone. Really, the only defense that Attorney Schlemmer had was the argument that there had been evidence tampering or contamination. Mm. I mean, she literally had nothing else. Mm-hmm. She tried to say it was a friend of Michael's that was responsible for Denise's death, but she called no witnesses. It just...
And just planted, like, hunks of her hair in his car.
Yeah. She had really, like I said, public defender who... She had to take the case. Well, I don't know if she had to take the case.
Yeah.
But
you've got nothing else to go
exactly.
off.
Exactly. Huh. Exactly. Now, one of the interesting and further tragic things to come out of the trial was the misrouting of Jane's 911 call. So you remember my intro about how Denise called 911.
Right.
And it's not just from her call, but you would think that with, what, 5 or 6 911 calls
right.
that someone would be able to help her.
Like a general location.
Exactly. So they did actually know, they were in the vicinity and they were looking for the Camaro. And of course I didn't, oh no, I did put this in my notes, so I won't read it yet. But for Jane's call, she was the one who heard Denise screaming in the car at the stoplight. So it turned out her call had not been forwarded to the proper authorities because it was not filed correctly. The operator just shouted across the aisle because there was so much chaos happening in the dispatcher's office that they thought they heard her, but they just didn't, like the dispatcher thought they heard the other dispatcher. They just didn't get it into the system and they thought they were going to do it, but it didn't. They didn't send the tip out to the police just because of all the chaos.
That hurts my heart.
Yes.
Because what if?
Yes. Well, yes, but one deputy said that he was parked on the road that Michael had turned onto when Jane lost sight of him. So they likely drove right by him, but he knew they were looking for a Camaro. So he kind of like should have said something. It had nothing to do with Jane's call was not make or break. Mm. So a bit of debate on that one.
He was playing Candy Crush and then was like, wonder what kind of car that was.
I literally wonder if he was just like thinking, I don't know, maybe, I don't know why he didn't see it, but he didn't.
I would be really bad at a job like that because I will be like, okay, focus now.
Yes.
Squirrel. And then I'm like, no, focus. Yep. And your mind just wanders and you're distracted.
And all it would take is a second, especially if it's going the opposite direction.
Yes.
Yeah. So when Jane saw Denise's abduction on the news the day after, she realized that that was what she'd witnessed. Not a child abduction, and called police. After an internal investigation in the Charlotte County Sheriff's Office, 4 of the call center workers were ordered to do remedial training, and the 2 dispatchers involved received a few days suspension. Mm. It's really all they could do. And then, like I was saying, something to note, the sheriff said that they already knew they were looking for that Camaro, so it wouldn't necessarily, yes, they needed to have routed it correctly and should have, but it may not have meant that Denise would be alive today. Mm. On August 28th, 2009, after 2 hours and 5 minutes of deliberation, the jury found Michael guilty of kidnapping with intent to commit a felony, sexual battery, and first-degree murder. During the penalty phase, and remember from my last episode that by federal law, capital cases must be split into a trial for the guilt and for the sentencing.
Well, they went for the death penalty.
They did.
Okay.
Yep. They should have gotten, Attorney Britt from my last case.
Hell yeah.
Michael, they really didn't need it in this case, though. Michael's lawyer brought on Dr. Joseph Chong Sang Wu, who conducted a PET scan on Michael. According to Dr. Wu, and you mentioned this earlier, the PET scan demonstrated abnormal activity within his frontal lobe. Mm-hmm. Dr. Wu concluded that this abnormal activity was consistent with a traumatic brain injury. The PET scan also revealed an abnormal notch or divot in Michael's frontal lobe at the top of his head. Dr. Wu's testimony reiterated the story that when Michael was 6 years old, he had suffered a head injury in a sledding accident, and his siblings reported that his behavior changed significantly after the accident. Dr. Wu testified that individuals who suffer frontal lobe injuries are more likely to have poor judgment, exhibit blunted affect. That's funny. That's the word you struggled with. Mm-hmm. Affect. How is it, Marina?
Affleck.
Affleck. take excessive risks, have difficulty regulating impulses such as aggression, mm-hmm. and have difficulty separating fantasy from reality. With regard to the latter, Dr. Wu was provided with statements from the family members reporting that when Michael was 17, after watching the movie The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, he obtained a chainsaw and started chasing family members with it.
Oh my gosh.
While exhibiting no expression on his face.
That's concerning.
Extremely.
I would be like, we're never going to a family barbecue ever again.
Yeah, you think yours is bad?
I always say that I could be an Olympic runner mm-hmm. if you put mm-hmm. someone with a chainsaw behind me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't even like going to the like haunted houses where they have the chainsaws without the chains. I don't like those.
One time I went and we opened the door to a house and there was a guy standing there with a chainsaw. So I took my friend and I shoved her into him and I took off running to save myself.
And that was the last time she ran.
Man with said chainsaw thought it was hysterical. So he chased after me until like it was too far. So then he stopped. And when I went back, my friend was still standing where I pushed her into him. She had fully peed her pants.
Oh, no. Oh, that's awful.
Yeah. It was kind of my fault.
It was 100% your fault. 100%. So you need to stay away from him is for sure.
Yeah, that's one of numerous reasons why I should stay away from him.
Michael also, at the age of 13, while acting out a cartoon, nearly killed his brother with a bow and arrow.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
So, and after the sledding injury, he required special education services. Mm-hmm. It was no surprise that the state's victim impact statements and other evidence during the sentencing trial were compelling. On September, and I actually didn't quote any of those because I'm telling you, I actually had a hard time with this case. On September 4th, 2009, the jury recommended death. And in Florida, the trial judge makes the final decision. Michael was sentenced to death. And although he, of course, appealed it, the Florida Supreme Court denied his appeal with a particularly scathing decision that I'll read a few excerpts from. King abducted a young mother from her home, leaving her two children, an infant and a toddler, unattended. He transported her to his house, where she was bound with duct tape, raped, and sodomized. He then acquired a shovel, drove her to an abandoned construction site, and shot her in the head. Given the angle of the entrance wound and the fact that a substance appearing to be ocular fluid was found in the car, it is logical to conclude that Lee was not blindfolded at the time of her shooting, and she saw the gun as it was placed against her head. Furthermore, because Lee was abducted from her home between 1 and 2 p.m. on the 17th, and her 911 call was made at 6:14 p.m., it can be deduced that Lee was held captive by King for over 4 hours. As noted in the sentencing order, rarely is a court able to experience what a deceased victim encountered. In this case, anyone who listens to the 911 call placed by Denise Lee will hear the abject terror she was experiencing, plus her panicked, frantic pleas to the 911 dispatcher for help and to King to be returned home. This murder was unquestionably cold and cruel.
I have, my heart is like pounding.
Yeah. It's, and I did look, because I'm a masochist, I did look to see if I could listen to the 911 call, and it has not been released to the public. The transcript was available in the court documents that I read, and it's just, it's very frustrating because you can see the operator trying to figure out what the hell this mm-hmm. phone call is. And clearly Denise can't respond. And I guess Michael had the music on super loud. So the operator was having a hard time hearing and it like took a while to piece everything together. And even then I'm not sure it was totally clear. It's just really awful. And Denise's father did listen to it. Ugh. Cause he had to identify that it was her. Just, very awfully unique.
I also very much do not like the phrase ocular fluid.
I know. I tried not to go too much into that. For our gremlins who might not know what that is, that's got to do with your eye. I'll leave the rest to your imagination.
It belongs in your eye.
It does.
Not in people's cars.
Yeah. The also in the court documents were the results from the medical examiner's autopsy, and it was rough. Rough. She had a really, really horrific end to her life.
Poor Denise.
Michael is currently on death row, as he should be. Denise's funeral was on January 23rd, 4 days after she was found. Hundreds of police officers came out to support her father. There was a 30-mile funeral procession.
Oh my gosh.
Just crazy. 6 months later, Nate created the Denise Amber Lee Foundation with the goal of being the emotional driving force for changes in the 911 system in order to minimize human error. Foundation officials travel the country trying to improve 911 centers, which often have minimal training requirements and do not adhere to industry best practices. Among the organization's accomplishments, the foundation had a breakout year in 2014, collecting $130,000 to fund 911 accountability efforts. Foundation leaders have helped pass 911 training laws in a number of states, including Florida, and Nate himself has become a popular instructor and speaker on 911 reform across the country. To learn more about the foundation and find out how to donate, visit deniseamberlee.org, and we'll put that in our notes. Rick, Denise's father, managed to get a bill passed unanimously in her name, the Denise Amber Lee Act, on April 24th, 2008. The act provides optional training for 911 operators. You would think that training would be standardized for such a job. Mm-hmm. And in fact, usually industries like that, so hospitals and that sort of thing, have accrediting bodies that set standards for good performance. And it hasn't been the case for 911 centers, which was fascinating to me.
Wow.
A 2009 Herald Tribune investigation found that just 15 of the roughly 250 centers across Florida were accredited at the time.
Just 15?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Wow. Crazy.
Yep. Encouraging more standardization among 911 centers through accreditation and other means was one of the major recommendations that came out of an in-depth study of Florida's 911 system completed by the Gulf Coast Community Foundation in 2009. The high prices charged by national accrediting agencies have been the deterrent for some of the Florida 911 centers. Oh. So Nate's Denise Amber Lee Foundation and Rick's Denise Amber Lee Act are really significantly improving things by helping to raise standards and create a cheaper and more streamlined process to accreditation. Oh. So it's literally just money and like money.
Right.
That's the only thing.
The only thing that's keeping.
And again, like I think I do want to call back to like, I think it's tragic that the 911 call was misrouted and mm-hmm. would it have maybe helped? Yes. I unfortunately don't think it would have saved Denise's life.
Right. But you have to cling to something, you know, like that's
exactly,
that's what they had to, because you can't fund a anonymous crime.
I know.
Center. So
I know. And it's certainly, but, it's for a good thing. It's not like it's,
yeah. They're going to save future yes, lives.
Exactly. Exactly. And the family is still lobbying for a new law to be passed that would require mandatory training. So there is some training, yeah. But I think they're trying to get more.
I would want to be trained to death if yeah. I was a 911 yeah. operator.
I am way too high strung for that kind of job.
Yeah.
I would pass out in the first day. It would be way too stressful.
You'd be like, stay calm, ma'am. Oh my God.
They'd like, be like, no, you should stay calm.
You stay calm, ma'am. Yeah.
Oh, man. Speaking of looking for justice anywhere, Nate filed a wrongful death suit with the Charlotte County Sheriff's Office for the mishandling of Jane Kowalski's 911 call. Mm-hmm. This was especially awkward because Rick still worked there as a detective. But 4 years after Denise's death, the case was settled privately.
Yeah.
Though it seems impossible for him to pick up the pieces after such a tragedy, Nate continues to care for his beloved boys and has even picked up his trumpet again, playing aww. In concert with another symphony. Really, really sad.
That is really, really sad.
Just, you know, it's one of those where the changing of the law and having the foundation are good, but pretty much everything else is miserable. I mean, I don't want anyone sentenced to death. I want them to just not commit the crime in the first right. place. And it sounds like Michael had a whole lot wrong with him. Mm-hmm. So that's a tragedy in and of itself, not excusing his behavior, but
no.
that's a tragedy. And then obviously Denise's loss of life was tragic. And then her poor kids, you know, it just, everyone, I don't like it. Why did I do this no. case?
I don't know. And I wonder, like I said, I was wondering before whether Michael did that to anybody else, but he got caught by like a lot of people yeah. doing it to Denise. So I feel like yeah. he was not a good criminal.
No, I don't think he did it to anyone else. Also, yeah, he was driving her around. It was broad daylight. It was
yeah,
like 3 o'clock really, in the afternoon.
He did a bad
with
job.
With a tied up person in, like not in the trunk. She was in the passenger seat.
Right.
Just tied up. So fortunately, he was caught. It just was at the cost of Denise's life, which is...
I'm so mad that so yeah. many calls came in and they couldn't yeah, intercept it in time.
It's so frustrating because I think they said at one time, naturally, this is my brain, not my notes. At one time, within a mile radius, there were like 4 or 5 police cars. But it's just, you know, they just didn't see them.
And, I know.
It was just, all at the wrong time. They were just behind. So
wow, that was thoroughly depressing.
Yeah, you're welcome. Hey, if you're enjoying listening, Grim, despite the depression and my annoying voice, you know, glad I can provide for all of you. If you're enjoying it, make sure you're getting the most in between episodes. You can find us on Instagram at Grim Crime Podcast and on Facebook, just search Grim : A True Crime Podcast. Or even better, you can subscribe to our Patreon by searching Grim : A True Crime Podcast on the Patreon app or website. Depending on the tier you choose, you'll get a shout out. You know you heard us in the beginning. Maybe I will get the higher register at some point. Bonus episodes and even access to our supremely awesome Discord server. You can send us an email at grimcrimepodcast@gmail.com. And that's also where you can send us case suggestions, which I think this was a case suggestion. I just didn't write down who it was. So if you suggested this, thank you. Wherever you do listen, please rate us, or even better, leave us a written review. Thanks for being here, and remember, listen, learn, and stay alive until next time, because the future is grim.